At any rate, we will now proceed with the main body of tonight's archive show, the destabilization of the USSR and Eastern Europe, a prelude to World War III. And we will begin by taking a look at an individual with whose politics I disagree fiercely, but I think precisely for that reason, the fact that he is of the same sorts of views as the people who have been running this country for quite some time. I think his thoughts vis-a-vis President Gorbachev's unsuccessful Middle Eastern peace initiative are worth going into here. I'm going to read you now a section of an editorial from the San Francisco Sunday Examiner and Chronicle. This from Sunday, February 24th of 1991. This is by the editor of that paper, William Randolph Hearst, Jr. It's entitled A Fateful Weekend, and I'm going to read you a short section of it. There is reason to believe he acted Gorbachev. There is reason to believe he acted primarily in the interest of preserving his political power and military support in the Soviet Union. He has been under strong pressure from the Soviet military high command to stop the Allied attacks on Iraq and prevent the United States from becoming the dominant superpower in the Middle East. Iraq was the Soviet Union's main ally in that region, and it purchased most of its weapons. It purchased most of its weapons and heavy military equipment from the Soviet Union. The Soviet leader is under constant pressure from moderate parliamentarians, communist hardliners, and disillusioned hungry people to step down. His chief political opponent, Russian Republic President Boris Yeltsin, has accused him of planning to establish a dictatorship. In a television interview broadcast across the Soviet Union this week, Yeltsin called for Gorbachev's immediate resignation. Gorbachev obviously hopes to mollify the military and restore his public popularity by becoming the man of peace and a major influence in the Middle East, thus protecting the southern flank of the Soviet Union. The danger is that his betrayal of Western and Allied Arab interests in the Iraq crisis may bring about a return of the Cold War. These last two paragraphs again, because they're critical. Gorbachev obviously hoped to mollify the military and restore his public popularity by becoming the man of peace and major influence in the Middle East, thus protecting the southern flank of the Soviet Union. The danger is that his betrayal of Western and Allied Arab interests in the Iraq crisis may bring about a return of the Cold War. Well, it is my belief, and I've stated that before, that that is exactly what the powers that be in this country have in mind. I think they would like to restore the Cold War for a variety of reasons, and it's not just the powers that be in this country. The Germans have a phrase, Interessengemeinschaft, which means community of interests, and there are a number of elements in this community of interests that I think would like to see a return to the Cold War, and for a variety of different reasons. In the first place, the U.S. national security establishment, the military, and the inextricably related defense industries would like to see a return to the Cold War, because that will mean increased U.S. military spending and a return to the billions of dollars, the record profits that were raked in by these industries and individuals during the Reagan years. Beyond that, I think the multinational corporations, and it should be never be forgotten that fascism was a direct outgrowth of the multinational corporations, as we looked at in a number of archive shows, Uncle Sam and the Swastika, the first two Radio Free America shows, Radio Free America number 10, Uncle Sam and Il Duce, and Japanese fascism, its history and significance for contemporary Americans, multinational corporate capitalism, industrial capitalism in general, and fascism are inextricably linked. To make a very long story very short, fascism represented a militant armed response to the appearance of the first socialist country in the world, namely the Soviet Union, and the strong affinity between socialist movements around the world, at least for a time, and the Soviet Union. We will be repeating Uncle Sam and the Swastika once again this coming Memorial Day weekend. Those of you who are not familiar with this would do well to acquire those archive shows. They in many ways represent the foundation for the rest of the discussion that I engage in and have engaged in for so many years here on One Step Beyond. It is my opinion that the multinational corporations would like to see a return to the Cold War, at least for the time being, in order to ensure a couple of things. First of all, the eventual total demise not only of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, even though there has been democratization in the Soviet Union, and even though there has been a proposed entry or a proposed market economy for the Soviet Union, the fact of the matter is that as badly destabilized as it is, The Communist Party of the Soviet Union is still the single most important power element, and the multinational corporations do not want socialism, Marxist socialism in particular, of any form anywhere in the world, and they would like to see, in my opinion, and I think history and facts will bear this out, the complete elimination of the Soviet Communist Party. The destabilization of the Soviet Union and a return to the Cold War will be very destabilizing to the Soviet Union, as we shall see. A return of the Cold War would further weaken the Soviet Union and discredit the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. I think the multinationals would like to do that. Now, the underlying reason that they would like to do that, basically, is the R word, resources. Not only do the multinationals wish to proceed unchallenged in areas of the Third World or any place where they wish to exploit the resources and also the population, but in particular, the Soviet Union is an enormous reservoir of minerals, petroleum, and a number of different items which the multinationals have long sought to exploit. The conflict between countries like England, Germany, the United States, and Russia predates the appearance of socialism. Basically, the enormous booty, the mineral resources of Russia have long been sought by Americans, Britons, Germans, Japanese, Frenchmen, and people who are in a position to exploit and profit from those resources that predated the Soviet Union, but then when the Soviet Union came into being and became socialist, that greatly magnified and amplified the desire to conquer that country or destroy it politically so that this huge, huge reservoir of natural resources could then become available to the multinational corporations. And the multinational corporations are the dominant power in the world today. I think that the Japanese and Germans would very much like to see a return to the Cold War. Now that Germany is reunited, and now that the Soviet troops will be on their way out one way or another, probably pretty soon, the Japanese and Germans would like to see a return to the Cold War for a couple of different reasons. In the first place, the United States will be economically weakened by a continuation of the Cold War. The continued channeling of so much of our national, not only our capital, but our research and development brains into military production will weaken us competitively. That will benefit the Japanese and Germans. And beyond that, a continued weakening of the Soviet Union will see to it that the Soviet Union could never at any point become an economic power to rival Japan or Germany. As ludicrous as that might seem, assuming, just for the sake of argument, that the Soviet Union was able to make a transition ultimately to a parliamentary democracy and a free market economy with their enormous resources and with an excellent educational system, it is within the realm of possibility that at some point in the future, probably not for quite some time, but at some point in the future, the Soviets also might be in a position, well, at that point it probably would not be the Soviets, but whatever the country would be called if it ceased to become socialist, that country could rival Japan and Germany. It's huge, has a lot of resources, and if they could get away from the catastrophic military spending, which has cannibalized so much of their national wealth, it is within the realm of possibility that sometime in the next century they also might be in a position to challenge the emerging economic hegemony of the Japanese and Germans, the economic dominance of those two, quote, former, unquote, Axis nations in the world today. The United States has basically been channeling its capital into tanks rather than bulldozers. To make a long story short, there's a dynamic which I refer to from time to time called the tank versus the bulldozer, and it basically illustrates how military spending and civilian spending contrast. Basically, to make a long story short, and this is something of an oversimplification, if capitalism is going to succeed, capital must be invested in such a way as to generate more capital. Civilian spending is much, much better in this regard. Just consider if you spend your money on a tank, what happens? And consider if you spend that same money on a bulldozer, what happens? Well, first of all, the tank is government issue. It is paid for by the U.S. government. It is fueled, and tanks burn a lot of fuel by the U.S. government, and the U.S. government, of course, means you and I, the U.S. taxpayer. It goes on maneuvers. paid for by the U.S. government. It shoots machine gun bullets and shells, paid for by the U.S. government. It uses spare parts, paid for by the U.S. government, i.e. the U.S. taxpayer, in other words, you and I. Its crew people and its service people are paid for by the taxpayer. All of this serves, obviously, to add to the federal deficit. It serves to drain capital, and beyond the initial outlay for the contracts for the tanks, there is very little capital generated, or not nearly as much capital generated. On the other hand, if you take that same money and you sink it into a bulldozer, well, the bulldozer is paid for out of the private sector. Its fuel is paid for out of the private sector. The person who operates it is paid for out of the private sector. Its spare parts are paid for out of the private sector. That does not drain the federal treasury. That does not add to the federal deficit. And beyond that, and even more importantly, the bulldozer creates apartment buildings, it creates factories, it creates movie theaters, it creates shopping centers, it creates houses, and each of those things generate more capital. If you build a shopping center, people are going to go there, they're going to spend money. People are going to be employed there. They, in turn, will be spending money. If you build a movie theater, same thing. People spend money there, people are employed there, the people who are employees spend money. All of that generates more capital. You build a factory, same thing. That factory produces. It produces for the civilian economy. It employs people. Those people have discretionary income. They spend that. That generates more capital. That's what it's all about in a nutshell. The tank versus the bulldozer. Well, in the Reagan-Bush years, we have been spending our money on tanks rather than bulldozers, and that is one of the reasons why we are so rapidly losing our competitive edge in the world economy, to the great delight and enormous profit of the Japanese and the Germans. It is my feeling that they would like nothing better than to see a return to the Cold War, because it will further weaken us, and it will see to it that the Soviets don't ever become an economic rival, as far off in the future as that might seem to be. It is not outside of the realm of possibility. With their educational system, with a very heavy industrial base, and with their enormous resources, it is not outside of the realm of possibility that sometime in the next century, with successful reform and economic regeneration, the Soviets themselves might challenge the Japanese or Germans. Well, not bloody likely, at least under the present circumstances. And again, it should be borne in mind that the United States is run by its military and its defense industries. The defense industries wield an enormous influence in this country. One of the reasons why it is so important to look into to investigate this country's political assassinations, the assassination of President Kennedy in particular, is that it reveals just exactly how powerful and how deadly the defense industries are, and the extent to which they are in a position to turn the national agenda and bend it to their will if they so desire. One of the main reasons why President Kennedy was killed was that he was seeking to end the Cold War and to remove the United States from Vietnam. The defense industries, and obviously the military as well, did not like that. Generals don't get promoted in peacetime for digging latrines. They get promoted in wartime for fighting battles and hopefully winning them. Peacetime is not beneficial to the defense industry, and it's not beneficial to the military. War, cold or otherwise, is, and President Kennedy found that out the hard way, or really he found out just exactly what they were willing to do. That is to say, President Kennedy was in the process of threatening those profits unsuccessfully and to his own obvious eventual demise. In many ways, echo those of William Randolph Hearst in that editorial that I just looked at, were set forth, really, in an analytical article which appeared in that very same edition of the San Francisco Sunday Examiner and Chronicle. Once again, this is from the Sunday Examiner and Chronicle of February 24th of 1991, as was that previous Randolph Hearst editorial. This is an analysis article by A.S. Ross of the Examiner staff. It's headlined, "Gorbachev Loses His Touch as Bid for Peace Fails," subheaded, "Bush Circle Suspects His Withdrawal Plan as Attempt to Save Ex-USSR Client." And it reads in part as follows. "This attempt to stop the U.S. achieving all of its goals in the Gulf War is likely to prompt a reassessment in government circles of the Soviet partnership," said John Hanna, H-A-N-N-A-H, of the Washington Institute for Near East Studies. Again, quoting, "The heroic age of U.S.-Soviet relations, as short as it was, is gone. Now we're in for a period of damage control," unquote. Most analysts say that damage control was, in fact, the prime motivation of Gorbachev's initiative. That, once again, was Gorbachev's unsuccessful Middle East peace initiative, an attempt to forestall the Iraqi military defeat. Beginning again, most analysts say that damage control was, in fact, the prime motivation of Gorbachev's initiative. Already incensed by what they regard as the giveaway of Eastern Europe, powerful elements in the military and the Communist Party were voicing growing outrage at a similar abdication of Soviet power in the Middle East as Moscow quietly acquiesced in the U.S.-led campaign against Iraq. Quote, "The terms of U.S.-Soviet cooperation are becoming increasingly controversial in Moscow," said George Breslauer, Breslauer, a Soviet studies expert at UC Berkeley. Quote, "Gorbachev was already being accused of not just cutting losses, but cutting bone. Now they have to watch as a former client gets creamed," unquote. In addition, the Soviets have legitimate concerns. Fighting is taking place just 500 miles from their southern border, near the already restive Soviet Muslim population. And recall last week I said that I felt that among the many goals for the U.S. moving into the Middle East, and as I've said so many times and will repeat once again, when the U.S. National Security Establishment, that is to say its military and intelligence services, move on any major item, they do so when that will scratch a number of different itches at different levels simultaneously. And the biggest itch that is being scratched in the Middle East with this Middle East adventure, in my opinion, was to put pressure on the Soviet Union as part of a destabilization effort, an ongoing destabilization effort against the Soviet Union. With the U.S. having a huge military force rapidly deployed and successfully deployed on their southern flank, and with the result of that being an obvious increase in U.S. influence in that part of the world. The governments there and the situation there figures to be much more favorable to the United States for some time to come, regardless of how long the U.S. keeps substantial military forces in that part of the world. It'll be much easier for the U.S. to project a large military force into that part of the world in the future, even easier than it was this time, and they certainly did it quickly and successfully. The putting together of a very impressive military force, albeit one whose success has been overblown by the American media, still the impressive performance of some elements of the U.S. high-tech weaponry has not been lost on the Soviets, and as we looked at last week in the first installment, this has caused some serious reassessment by the Soviet General Staff. In particular, they have reassessed their air defense capabilities, and it is no secret in the U.S., in the Soviet National Security Establishment, that they feel that the reduced military spending by the Soviets, as badly needed as it is for their civilian economy, will place them in a few years at a serious disadvantage vis-a-vis the United States, and in particular vis-a-vis high-tech weaponry. I mentioned last week that the U.S. move onto the Soviet southern flank with the destabilization of the Baltics, a critical area strategically for the Soviet Union, represents an attempt to squeeze the Soviets, in my opinion, and I think the projection through the National Endowment for Democracy and its organizations, its organs, its tools in Lithuania, namely the LCRA, Lithuanian Catholic Religious Aid, and the Lithuanian Information Center, by projecting fascist elements into or reintroducing fascist elements into Lithuania, they are deliberately seeking to provoke the sort of military response which we saw a short time ago, in which a number of people were killed by tanks and Soviet troops. And as we looked at last week, the Soviet crackdown on the Baltics has been seen by the NATO nations as proof that you can't trust the Soviets and that we've got to stay strong. We closed out the first installment of this archive show, this archive series, with an article which discussed that. Even as the Warsaw Pact is dissolving, NATO is proceeding apace, and beyond that, some of the former Warsaw Pact countries may very well be joining NATO, or at least seeking ties to NATO. That figures to have a similar effect on the Soviets. It's got to make them edgier, and it figures to ultimately bring about the ascendance of hardliners and the military in the Soviet Union, and that figures to restart the Cold War with some of the results that I've already spoken about. And again, I should repeat something that I mentioned last week. Arguably the most basic military maneuver in military strategy is what is known as a flanking maneuver. Basically, you get your forces around the edge of your enemy's forces. This basically permits one or both of two things. Either you can attack the enemy from the rear, thereby destroying him, or else the enemy has to redeploy forces to face the threat from the rear, and this weakens his line of defense to a frontal assault. assault. It is, again, arguably the most basic of all and fundamental of all military maneuvers. We saw a very successful flanking maneuver in Iraq where a feint was used to basically keep Iraqi forces facing the front while a large allied military force went around their flank and proceeded to tear up their rear. And it is my opinion, as I said, that the destabilization of the Baltics and the U.S. pressure, the U.S. military adventure in the Middle East, rather, represent, in essence, flanking maneuvers. And I think this is intended to intimidate the Soviets, frighten them into basically returning to a hard line. It is intended, I think, to provoke the Soviet military. And this provoked Soviet military, the projected Soviet crackdown. Obviously, we've seen something of a crackdown already in the Baltics, will be used to restart the Cold War for reasons that I have already discussed. George Bush was reportedly very annoyed, although later articles said that he calmed down or that his opinion was moderated somewhat. George Bush was very angered by Gorbachev's peace initiative in the Middle East. Reading now from the San Jose Mercury News of Thursday, February 21st of 1991. Once again, the first two articles from the San Francisco Sunday Examiner and Chronicle from 2/24/91. This is an LA Times story, datelined Washington headlined, Gorbachev's peace efforts sap goodwill with the U.S. Just reading the beginning of it. Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev has jeopardized his warm relations with the United States by pushing a last-ditch Persian Gulf peace proposal to win greater Soviet influence in the Arab world at the expense of Allied goals, U.S. government analysts said Wednesday. Bush is, quote, biting his lip, unquote, to contain his unhappiness with Gorbachev's diplomatic efforts, according to one analyst, who said the Soviet president, quote, has done more to harm himself in Washington in the past 72 hours than he did by all the head-knocking in the Baltics, unquote. It'll be interesting to see just exactly what the response is. The late, great May Brussel, the foremost political researcher in this country in recent years, used to refer to George Bush as Killer Bush, and that's an appropriate title. Just how apt was May's title, I think, has become clear in recent years. Bush has been in office a little over 2 years, and so far he's averaging a war a year. It should never be forgotten that Bush is the former director of the CIA. You don't ever become CIA director and leave, and so far he has performed as the organ of the national security establishment that he quite obviously is and has always been. It'll be interesting to see what happens now that Gorbachev has crossed Killer Bush instead of giving him everything he wants. One of the things that we have gone into and we will be reviewing in weeks to come is how the Galen spy organization, the Nazi Eastern Front intelligence organization, which was imported into the United States at the end of World War II, became our Department of Russian and Eastern European Affairs, or the CIA's Department of Russian and Eastern European Affairs, became the de facto NATO intelligence organization, and finally became the Bundesnachrichtendienst, the BND, the West German Intelligence Service. Oh, I shouldn't say West German. That's no longer applicable. The German Intelligence Service, which it is to this day. The Galen organization also has very strong historical ties to the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, a very important organization and key element of the World Anti-Communist League. That has now been renamed, and I must say I have not learned its new name. It's as inappropriate as the National Endowment for Democracy. It's something like the World League for the Promotion of Freedom or Democracy, which is ludicrous. It is antithetical to both freedom and democracy. It's one of the reasons why I haven't bothered to relearn its name. The anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations is inextricably linked with the Galen organization, and as we looked at in a miscellaneous archive show entitled Nazis and Anti-Semites on George Bush's campaign, it maintains very close ties, that is to say the ABN, with the Republican Party, and specifically the Ethnic Heritage Council of the Republican Party. We will be reviewing some of that in weeks to come as well, and looking at some other information about the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations and its ongoing activities inside the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe. It should be noted that just as George Bush was very annoyed with Gorbachev, Gorbachev has sounded a few chill notes as well. Bearing in mind the profound influence of the U.S. national security establishment and the inextricable relationship of that national security establishment with the Galen Organization and the anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations, don't be surprised if dissident Soviet nationals wind up assassinating Gorbachev at some point. One of the important historical lessons to be learned, again, from the assassination of President Kennedy, or studying the truth about that particular event, is just how great the influence is of the U.S. intelligence system with elements of dissident Soviet nationalities. Those Soviet nationalities or elements thereof were used to help assassinate President Kennedy. Do not be too surprised if they wind up assassinating President Gorbachev as well, now that Gorbachev has dared to cross Killer Bush. It is my feeling that Gorbachev may very well actually be the West's man, or may have been. One of the unfortunate aspects of the legacy of the Galen Organization is having looked at the USSR literally through Hitler's eyes, and we will be reviewing in weeks to come just how profound the influence of the Galen Organization on our perceptions of the world and the USSR in particular has been. That also, by the way, will be a major element of the archive series that I do on how the United States lost the Second World War. Again, that will be the subject of a talk I will be giving for those of you listening live here on March 10th. On April 13th, I will be discussing this in part at Foothill College. Now, one of the tragic aspects of the legacy of the Galen Organization is that it's easier for an American to say what the Soviet Union isn't than what it is. It is not the world-gobbling monster we've been told. Beyond that, it is difficult for me to figure out exactly what goes through the Soviets' minds. If anything, they look awfully naive to me. I'll be talking about that in weeks to come. I don't know what Gorbachev has been thinking as he allows organizations like the Unification Church, people like Paul Weyrich, to operate inside the Soviet Union and very effectively. It occurs to me that the Soviets, that Gorbachev might even be the West's man, or was for a time. But he may just be a fool. I don't know. That's my own view. As optimistic as people were, and I share that optimism for a time, Gorbachev seems to have allowed an almost suicidal, at least from the well-being of the Soviet Union, an almost suicidal entry of not only people like Reverend Moon, but people like Jimmy Swaggart, Reverend Schuller from Southern California have been allowed to operate and broadcast into the Soviet Union. Those elements have been very destructive, in my opinion, in this country, and you really got to wonder what goes through their mind. The KGB, likewise, is not the insidious world-gobbling force that we've been told. My own impression of the KGB is one basically of incompetence. That may be wrong. Again, it's easier to say what they aren't than what they are, because our whole view of that part of the world has been so distorted as a result of looking at things through the eyes of Hitler's minion, Reinhard Galen. But you've really got to wonder what Gorbachev is doing when he allows people like Reverend Moon to operate in the Soviet Union. We shouldn't be allowing him to operate in this country. But anyway, he has done that, and I wonder to what extent Gorbachev could actually be compared with Lee Harvey Oswald. Oswald was a U.S. intelligence agent who was given a left cover and then infiltrated into various leftist organizations and obviously was assassinated before he could defend himself. He was wrongly accused of being the assassin of President Kennedy. He didn't kill anybody. There's no evidence whatsoever that he did. And he stated that. He said he was a patsy and he could prove it. He did not have the opportunity, obviously. There has been a lot of discussion in this country by right-wing elements, people associated with Lyndon LaRouche, among others, of the Soviets running large numbers of American politicians. The LaRouche organization and associated elements basically use a technique called mirror imaging. What mirror imaging basically involves is turning things around 180 degrees. Many of the things discussed in LaRouche literature are accurate scenarios, but they are switched at 180-degree political polarity. Things which the United States does are basically blamed on the Soviets. Real scams, but things which we're doing, and they're being portrayed as Soviet scams. I wonder, we can't say for sure, but I wonder to what extent the United States, in fact, controls elements of the Soviet political leadership, or perhaps Western intelligence, notably the Galen Organization. This, again, is a question. It's not a statement I'm making. It's a question I'm asking. But you've really got to wonder what goes through some of those people's minds. What in the world the Soviets think they're doing when they allow someone like Reverend Moon to operate inside the Soviet Union, and we'll be talking about that in weeks to come. It's beyond me. We shouldn't be allowing him to operate in this country, in my opinion, but it's obviously way too late for that. But anyway, I wonder if Gorbachev has actually been used as a tool by the United States. I certainly think he has been duped by the United States. It may be that he's starting to wake up, and he's starting to realize what is actually going on, and Gorbachev has basically warned of brittle relations in the United States with the United States. Reading now from the San Jose Mercury News of Wednesday, February 27th of 1991. This is an article by Steve Goldstein, G-O-L-D-S-T-E-I-N, of the Knight Ridder News Service. It's headlined, Gorbachev warns U.S. of Chile-Soviet reaction if ceasefire is rejected. It reads in part as follows. Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev warned Tuesday that improved U.S.-Soviet relations could be jeopardized if the White House did not soon accept a ceasefire in the war with Iraq. It was the first suggestion by the Kremlin that the warmer relationship between Moscow and Washington could be chilled by U.S. determination to continue the fight. The U.S.-Soviet relationship is still very brittle, quote-unquote, Gorbachev said. That has to, I think, get an award for understatement. Just how brittle it is, I think Gorbachev and a lot of other people are going to be finding out probably the hard way in the not-too-distant future. The sarcastic tone in my voice notwithstanding, I am very disturbed by what I see going on. I think there is a very distinct possibility that the destabilization of the Soviet Union, which we will be talking about after a musical break, could ultimately result in a Third World War. If the Soviets decide to go quietly and just give up the ghost politically and strategically, well, then there will not be a Third World War. We'll have, I don't know what the Soviet Union would be renamed when it's no longer socialist, but we will have a capitalist Russia of one kind or another. But if the Communist Party of the Soviet Union and the Soviet National Security Establishment in particular decide not to go quietly, if they decide not to just roll over and go belly up, there might be a Third World War, probably more as a result of miscalculation, but who knows? Who knows what the boys in Washington are actually thinking, and beyond that, the boys in Bonn and Tokyo. We shall see, but I am frankly very frightened by the prospects for the human race in the immediate future. We will now take a musical break, and then we will come back with more of tonight's archive show, a very, very important article which will serve as the foundation for much of the rest of this archive series and which will help to tie together a lot of what we have spoken about to date. Music, and then more of One Step Beyond.